Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderley. This hour on the program, our green energy future. Can you imagine a world in which homes and cars and industry and whole cities are powered by clean, non-polluting alternative energy sources, sources like wind and sunlight, infinitely renewable and non-polluting? A thriving post-industrial world booming with the wealth and harmony of a revolution in green power. That's the vision of my guest this hour, environmental activist Harvey Wasserman. He's senior editor of freepress.org, co-founder of nukefree.org. My guest is the author of Harvesting Wind Energy as a Cash Crop and his latest Solar Topia, our green-powered Earth, AD 2030. Welcome back, Harvey Wasserman.
Hey, great to have you here. Great to be here, Fred. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. 614-292-8513. Well, are we gonna, you take us forward to 2030 AD in Solar Topia. But are we doing a little better at developing alternative and renewable energy sources here in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely going to happen. I mean, the idea of a green powered Earth by 2030, I think, is an absolute necessity and an economic viability. It's really the only way our economy is going to be economically viable. We cannot continue with fossil fuels and nuclear power. We even have Al Gore now running around saying we're going to be 100% renewable in electricity by 2018, although as typical of Al Gore, it's not a clean vision. And the same is true of Google. The guy, Eric Schmidt, I think his name is, running around saying that we'll be totally green by 2030. I think they read my book. They never will credit Solar Topia with that kind of vision. But the fact is that I set out in Solar Topia to paint a portrait, a verbal portrait of what the world will physically look like in 2030 with renewable energy. And it's very easy to do. I mean, you could right now, if we could magically subtract all the fossil fuel and nuclear power plants that we have in the world and substitute them with renewables, the lights wouldn't flicker. We do have the technology to totally power this Earth with renewables right now.
So paint a picture for us of 2030 AD and a solar-powered and green-powered Earth.
Well, let's start with Ohio. Ohio really has pretty good wind resources in the northern part of the state in various spots. One of the things about that makes wind power attractive in Ohio is that there's plenty of transmission. Large-scale wind is basically a grid-based technology, and so we can get a significant percentage of our wind, of our electricity supply from wind, especially, by the way, in the lake. Lake Erie is a tremendous wind resource. If you look at maps of the United States, wind maps of the United States, Lake Erie is a deep, deep red, which is about class 7, which is about the best wind there is. It's relatively shallow. The wind sites are not that far from the big cities. So a very substantial percentage of our electricity could come from wind in Ohio. Hmm. Counterintuitive, but definitely true.
Yes, it's interesting. Are there any wind turbines up there now?
Four.
Four.
Yeah, in Bowling Green.
In Bowling Green.
The reason they're in Bowling Green is because Bowling Green is a municipal utility company. They own their own electric system, and so they could make the decision to go with wind. The private utility companies, especially First Energy, have been pretty hostile to renewable sources because First Energy owns two nuclear plants, and that's their competition. They don't want anything cutting into their nuclear investments.
Well, wouldn't you think that they'd say, look, not only can we have the nuclear investment, but we can have the wind power investment. We'll take it over, and we'll really promote that. We'll have both.
Well, you're presuming rationality, and that's unfortunately not the case with First Energy. They're the ones that blacked out the entire Northeast in 2003, and they're the ones who put the hole in the head of the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant. So the major task of getting to Solartopia is to finally shut down our nuclear plants and get the get away from coal and other fossil sources. But we also need a restoration of mass transit. One of the things that I'm very focused on, a lot of people are focused on here in Ohio, especially central Ohio, is restoring passenger rail service between Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland, and then, of course, across to Indianapolis and Pittsburgh and up to Youngstown and Toledo. We had a great passenger rail service system in this country and even in the state as late as the 1950s. This is one of those conspiracy theories that's true. It was clearly consciously destroyed by General Motors, Standard Oil, the glass and rubber companies. There was a federal trial about it in the 50s. So in Solartopia, I talk very strongly about restoring mass transit, which is a major, major piece in getting to a totally green-powered world.
Talking about a green-powered world, President-elect Obama and I believe his Energy Secretary nominee, Stephen Chu, apparently favor nuclear power as part of that mix. Can it be done safely and cleanly?
No. Nuclear power is a disaster. It's a 50 years of proven failure. The first commercial reactor opened at Shippingport, Pennsylvania in 57. Now we're in 2009. It's uneconomical. It's unsafe. It's unreliable. All the reactors are potential terror targets. We need to shut these plants as quickly as possible. There's nothing green about them. They are contributors to greenhouse gases, to global warming, and they are phenomenally expensive. If we had taken the resources that went into nuclear power and put them into renewables, as was called for in 1952 by a report from the Truman administration, we wouldn't be in the Middle East right now. We'd have never had the war in Iraq. We wouldn't be so dependent on oil that we have to go to war for it.
Couldn't there be a safe design for a nuclear power plant that would avoid totally the possibility of a catastrophic meltdown? And
Never been done. And won't be done. It's a technology that's simply destined not to work.
Doesn't France have, 75% of their power comes from nukes, and they've had no big problems, right?
They have major problems. They don't have anything to do with their waste. The reprocessing facility is a catastrophic polluter at La Hague. The industry is unreliable. It's extremely expensive. It's also very brittle. They can't they have massive national power shortages at some points and national overloads at other points. The French did a terrible thing by going to nuclear. They're not building new ones in France, by the way. They're trying to export them. They're building a new one in Finland, which is already 2 years over behind schedule and $2.5 billion over budget. So it's a technology that's not going to be with us. We really have the irony is that what really works is renewables. Wind power is now the cheapest form of new electricity generation that you can build. The plants routinely come in under budget, ahead of schedule. There's nothing. It's not rocket science. These windmills, the first windmills operated, we believe, in Persia in around the 1400s. There was actually a windmill in New Amsterdam, in Manhattan, in the 1660s. So this technology has been with us a long time. Utility scale wind power has now been, I won't say it's perfected, but it's certainly cheaper than anything else to build right now. We have photovoltaic cells, which convert electricity convert sunlight to electricity, coming on very rapidly. Solar water heating, space heating. There was just an article in the New York Times about a German home that uses virtually no energy for heating. It's just, you know, in a cold climate, it just faces south. It's well insulated. These are the technologies. These are no longer the alternative technologies. It's really what I call in Solartopia, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, King Kong. Is the problem. Renewables are with us. They're the mainstream energy now.
Environmental activist Harvey Wasserman in our studios. His new book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email questions to openline at WOSU.org. Don is our first caller. Hello, Don.
Hello. Hey, I heard a seminar by a geologist, and he said that they had some wind turbines set up in Southern California, and environmentalists got them shut down because they killed too many birds.
That's actually in Northern California. There's it is possible if you really work at it to kill birds with wind turbines. It's hard to do. The big utility scale windmills go very, very slowly. And they have these unipoles. I mean, it's just a straight up and down tower where the birds can't perch. But in the late 70s, early 80s, 17,000 windmills were constructed in California, and a bunch of them were put up at a place called Altamont Pass, which is east of San Francisco. And these have latticework towers that raptors, birds of prey, will perch on, and the windmills are pretty fast. They're about a 20th the size, or even a 30th in some instances of the windmills that are being built now. So these go pretty quickly. The birds perch, they see a groundhog or a squirrel or a prairie dog, and they dive and they get clunked by the blade. Now, the environmental community is working to force these guys, the owners of this plant, to shut it down and to substitute the bigger unipole machines there, and that they won't. Those won't harm the birds.
Don, what do you think?
Sounds good.
Yeah, thanks.
Harvey, thanks, Don.
That was easy.
Well, I don't know how easy it is because I've been led to understand by my readings that no matter where, no matter what kind of wind turbine you have and no matter where you set it, there's going to be some bird kill.
Rarely. The average, worldwide, the average kill per wind machine, even the really big ones that generate a lot of electricity, is less than one per machine per year.
One bird per machine per year.
We estimate about 30,000 birds per year are killed by windmills around the world, as compared to 1 million from skyscrapers, cats, cars. It's unfortunate that any birds at all are killed, but if you compare that to the fish kill from a nuclear plant or even a coal-fired plant at the intake pipes, it's minuscule.
So if I go up to see a wind turbine that's designed in a certain way and sufficiently sighted, I'm not going to find birds littering the landscape, birds under the windmill.
Well, they're too slow. I mean, it takes a really suicidal bird to fly into a slow-moving windmill. I mean, I suppose you could scatter Prozac on the ground or something, but...
Birds don't necessarily see, and, you know, the windmill, do they? Do they see the revolving blades?
The big windmills are too slow. They're fast at the tip. But in order for a bird to fly into a windmill, it's very, very rare, a big one. The smaller ones with the latticework towers, as I said, if the birds are perching on the tower and they dive through it, it's a problem. We don't build those anymore. And by the way, you know, Ohio, I have a company called Farmers Green Power. We're working to bring windmills to Ohio. And it's very viable here. They're going up all over the state. It is a technology that works. And one of the reasons it works in Ohio – well, the two reasons it works in Ohio, A, we have high electric rates, and B, we have transmission wires all over the state. And with the big wind, of course, is in the Great Plains, but the Great Plains between the Mississippi and the Rockies is not close to urban areas, and there are transmission challenges there, which we don't have here in Ohio. So you're going to see a lot of wind farms in Ohio. It is a viable technology for this state.
Mm-hmm. How come entrepreneurs are not hopping? I mean, why don't
they
we?
They are.
But you know, as you said, there are four windmills up near Lake Erie, and this is a huge wind source. And what you know, this
There's
has been known for
with
years,
the utility
right?
system. The utility system is dominated by very large companies. You know, we were supposed to have, and I was on your show 10 or so years ago arguing against deregulation in this state. The utility companies were, you know, they deregulated. They took $9 billion from the ratepayers to pay off their bad nuclear debts. And then they were supposed to bring us, we were supposed to have competition. And, of course, we don't in Ohio. There's no such thing as competition in the electric power business. As a result, we have monopolies, First Energy in the north, AEP. Here in central Ohio is a little more wind friendly. They understand the business. AEP actually owns large wind farms in Texas. The biggest problem is getting onto the grid. And, you know, there are challenges that are posed by utility companies that are hostile to renewables because, you know, they make a show of being green, but they own large coal and nuclear power plants, and they don't want those investments challenged.
If you were to set up windmills along Lake Erie, can a major utility prevent you from getting your power on the grid, and how would they do that?
You have to have power contracts, and it's difficult. The way the utility system is set up now, you have to negotiate a power purchase agreement with a utility company, and that's the largest stumbling block, really, to the progress of wind power now. Now, we have private industrial concerns that are building windmills for their own use, and it's quite profitable. One thing you got to understand about wind power in this country, it is very profitable, way more profitable than nuclear power, which is totally subsidized. We have small subsidies in place for windmills. They're federal, some are state, in places like Minnesota. But the reality is that windmills are ahead of the game in the marketplace. I had a radio show for a while in downtown, as you recall, WVKO, the Solartopia show, and I had people on from the industry. And here in this down economy, in the solar industry, in the wind industry, in energy efficiency, in this down economy, virtually everyone I had on from the green power industry in Ohio was talking about having doubled their business in the last couple of years. It's the one sector in this economy that is really booming in a healthy way.
But what do you think accounts for we read stories of community opposition to wind power for various reasons around the country?
Usually it's scenic, and I think it's legitimate. People don't want to look at them, that's fine. There's a very clear and easy way around that, which is you allow the communities to own the windmills. There's a huge, huge attitude shift among people who are going to look at a windmill that where the profits go to a large corporation,
sure,
as opposed to one where you can calculate if you own a windmill, when it goes around, you can calculate how much you make on each revolution. And there are people in Minnesota who stand there and, well, there's another nickel. I mean, you know, that's how it goes. And just for your interest, the Cape Wind Project in Massachusetts, which is, of course, the Kennedys are opposing and has gotten so much attention. This is a very very large wind farm being proposed in the waters.
2 miles out or something.
Yeah, between the Cape Cod, Nantucket, and Martha's Vineyard. And if I lived there, as I have in the past, I would oppose that facility because I don't think it's justified for a private corporation to put large wind facility into public land and to privately profit from that. If that facility, if that Cape Wind project, the same windmills in the same location had been owned by the communities of the Vineyard, Cape, and Nantucket, it would have been spinning 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've got a private developer who's going into public land. People are going to have to look at it. Now, some people don't want to look at windmills. That's perfectly legitimate. You take a vote, 51%, that goes in. But I guarantee you that if that facility was owned by the people of that region, it would have been pumping out electricity.
But has the Kennedy family said that? In other words, if it had been owned by the towns and villages in that region, would they support it? I don't think so. They had the problem with the view.
But they wouldn't have been able to stop it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way they could have stopped it. If that was community owned, there is no way anybody could have stopped that. And that's why the windmills in Ohio are in Bowling Green. There is a very clear, in Solartopia, the vision is of community owned power, where the community, and one of the beauties of renewable energy, of wind and solar and biofuels and the other forms of increased efficiency, are that this is technology that can become controlled on a local level, where the public will profit as opposed to large corporations.
We're talking about a township owning it, if it's
Absolutely.
On their land or a
well,
city.
Well, Bowling Green is booming with them. Bowling Green loves their windmills.
And Bowling Green, where the city owns it, a municipal power plant.
Yes, it's a municipally owned utility company.
Yeah.
Oh, Columbus has a muni.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, we owned the power plant, the trash burner, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake. But if other forms of renewable energy we could put into this town, and we would own it, and the public would benefit from it.
What kind of renewable energy would work in Columbus? I wouldn't think wind energy would work very well here.
It's marginal here, that's for sure. There will be a time when wind energy will pay here because the electric rates will be so high and the technology will be somewhat advanced, although we've really – we do not need a new Manhattan Project for renewable energy. It's not a question of research. It's a question of development. You know, when they developed the atomic bomb, it was done from scratch. We are hardly at scratch with wind and solar and the other forms of biofuels. Now, Columbus could do biofuels. We certainly could do hot water heating, and photovoltaics, which are the cells that convert sunlight to electricity, are pretty much at the margin now. I mean, we're close to where photovoltaics really start to make sense, even in central Ohio, which is not the sunniest place on earth, as you well know.
We'll talk more about that. Let's go to our caller here, Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Fred. And I am interested particularly in finding out more about using photovoltaics. I have a residence, and I'd heard about companies that were doing leases of photovoltaic systems. But when I investigated further, nobody seems to actually be doing it, particularly not here in Ohio. And it seems to me to be a great win-win, both for the company as well as for the residential owner. But nobody
Yes.
seems to be doing it.
Well, actually, the deregulation bill that was passed by the Ohio legislature has very strong counter-incentives to putting in renewables. It was a terrible bill, and it really put up barriers, and we're hoping that the Strickland administration and hopefully some new blood and the legislature will reverse a lot of this bad legislation that made it difficult to do this. You can write me at windhw@aol.com, windhw@aol.com, or go to the solartopia.org website and contact me about that, and I'll help you get in touch, anyone who's listening, with putting in these facilities. There are businesses in central Ohio and around the state that are doing very well with renewables.
For your home.
Yeah, for your home. Mm-hmm. The most cost-effective and has been for quite a while is hot water heating. It's very expensive to heat water, either with electricity or with gas. And the solar does work here in central Ohio and is cost-effective. And I'll be happy to put anyone who emails me in contact with a company that will do it.
I'd be very interested because, I mean, even if you're not supporting the you're generating, even if you're not generating all of your electricity via solar, it would seem to me that even if you're offsetting 75% of your bill, that would be a dramatic.
Yes, we do have net metering in the state. You can turn the the meter backwards. Unfortunately, you don't get as much money for putting into the system what you have to pay to take it out. But there is still that possibility of doing it, and that law needs to change too.
Net metering means you sell back. If you have excess surplus power in your home, you sell it back.
That's correct.
To the company.
To the company.
And the grid, yeah.
Right.
And the reason I'm interested in that is because it seems to me that the system that you would put into your residence would be less expensive because you don't have to deal with all the battery aspects of solar.
That's correct.
And you know, it would also be a win for the for the power company, in the sense that even though they have to buy it back, you're still using power from them, and you're still tied into them. So you're still a customer.
Right, but the power companies in Ohio have been not progressive about this, and not aggressive about pushing renewables. I mean, they tend to spend as much on utility companies in general tend to spend as much on PR, saying how green they are, than on actually being green. So, you know, this is a problem. It's a political problem. We should have had solartopian technologies going a long time ago. Frankly, for the benefit of the state, I think the number one thing we have to do is restore mass transit. The home stuff is excellent. It's important. It does support businesses, and it does have a very positive payback, even here in Ohio. Again, as you can write me, WindHW, WINDHW@AOL, or look at the solartopia.org website. But we do have these technologies available. The largest political fight in terms of cutting down on our fossil fuel usage is definitely to restore mass transit.
Mm-hmm. Robert, thanks for your call. Next up is Steve. Hello, Steve.
Don't you think that one of the problems you have with these utilities is the profit motive, that an individual gets a hold of a corporation and they just make a huge amount of money for themselves, whereas you're talking about a community trying to make money, or at least keep its costs down, by using these things? You're going to have these corporations always fighting you on this.
Absolutely. That's definitely been the case. And like I said, that's why we have windmills in Bowling Green. And Bowling Green's been, by the way, wants to build more. I mean, if you look at the history of the wind in Bowling Green, they built two 1.8 megawatt machines, which are pretty big. Actually, they're 500 feet from tip to ground. It's 275 feet to the nacelle, which is like the propeller housing. And then the propellers themselves, the blades are 225 feet. So when the one blade is straight up, it's 500 feet. And they put in two in the town dump, actually, which is a great spot. You will see, by the way, most of the utility companies, most of the municipal utilities or the towns that build windmills start with the dump, and then they go to the schoolyard. And so across the Great Plains in Iowa and other Minnesota, you're seeing windmills popping up on near football fields.
Okay, and I have another question. I heard on a program last week that wind farms, large wind farms, create microclimates that could contribute to local weather warming. Is there what's the deal with that?
It's potentially possible. Anything's possible. You know, every green technology, like any other technology, is going to have surprises. And it is possible that the microclimates can evolve in an area where the windmills are dominant. We haven't seen much of it. I have a friend in Minnesota who owns 17 pretty good-sized windmills, 600-kilowatt machines, in a relatively small area. But he's never had a bird kill, and doesn't seem to have any climactic problems. But these are things we have to keep an eye for. You know, some green technologies have not worked out. We thought trash burning was going to be a good green technology. It seemed to make a lot of sense. But, you know, bottom line is you can't burn plastic. And that's why we had to shut the trash burner here. There will be other surprises, but there aren't many more surprises that we know about nuclear plants. Everything we know about them is bad, and coal is right behind it, so fossil fuels. So we have to make this change, and we have to be careful as we make it. I'm glad you raised that issue.
Yeah, well, the other thing about nuclear technology that nobody even thinks about is there's a finite amount of uranium.
That's true. And any, you know, there was all this talk about a fast breeder, which was going to create more fuel from the original fuel. It didn't work out. It's utter nonsense. And nuclear power is just as beholden to finite sources of fuel as anyone else.
Steve, thanks for your call. With environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, his new book, Solartopia, A Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Back after these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Things getting a little tense at work?
I'm clicking!
Don't let a busy day get the best of you.
Okay, forget it.
Even when you're busy, day-to-day keeps you informed with what's happening in the world. And we even let you have a little fun.
It's great.
Make the most of your time.
A million things I can do.
Join us for NPR's Day-to-Day.
Day to Day begins in 30 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. That's Christine at 247-4469. And thank you for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, mostly sunny skies and a high near 37. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 23. A good chance of afternoon rain tomorrow, maybe a little snow mixing in there. And cloudy skies tomorrow with a high around 39. Rain overnight tomorrow night with a low around 33. And for Wednesday, rain showers mixing with snow and a high of 35. Currently 30 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 and NPR News. This hour, our green energy future, imagining a world in which homes and cars and industry and whole cities are powered by clean, non-polluting alternative energy sources like wind and sunlight. They're infinitely renewable and non-polluting, a thriving post-industrial world booming with the wealth and harmony of a revolution in green power. That's the vision of my guest this hour, environmental activist Harvey Wasserman. He's senior editor of freepress.org, co-founder of nukefree.org. My guest is the author of Harvesting Wind Energy as a Cash Crop and Solartopia, A Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. We're at 614-292-8513 for your questions and comments at openline at wosu.org for brief emails. Harvey, you say Bowling Green, the municipal power plant, has four windmills. Well, those wind turbines, what percentage, I mean, what does that generate? That's not much, is it?
Yeah, it's a pretty fair amount of what Bowling Green gets. I don't know what the...
1% or half a percent?
Oh, no, it's more than that. You know, Bowling Green's not that big, but the fact is that they're building more, mm-hmm. and they work. They came in ahead of schedule and under budget. When have we ever heard of that before? So, you know, the wind technology has been, I won't say it's been perfected, but it's certainly been mastered. And there's nothing really revolutionary anymore about utility-scale wind power. Germany has gone so far as to pretty much fill up their landmass with to the best available sites. They're pretty much all taken now in Germany, and they're moving offshore, which the one major challenge to offshore wind is salt corrosion. Mm-hmm. The Danes actually built a pretty large offshore wind farm and have had serious problems with salt corrosion. We won't have that in Lake Erie. You know, that's one of the great attractions of Lake Erie is its fresh water. There may be problems with icebergs in Lake Erie, you know, other than that, it's really a no-brainer. And what the city of Cleveland is looking, the Cleveland Foundation in particular, is looking very aggressively to start building windmills in Cleveland, mm-hmm. so that they can then, you know, have local-based power.
Who owns all these windmills in Germany?
There's a very complicated in Denmark too. There's a complicated ownership system. The utilities, private developers, and the public share the ownership in many instances with these. And it's a good question. And mm-hmm. the question is really not. We will have wind power. We're going to have huge quantities of wind power in the United States. The question is who's going to own it. You've already got a $250 million wind farm in Iowa that's owned by Warren Buffett. We saw T. Boone Pickens making all these moves for a multi-billion-dollar investment in Texas. So in Minnesota, the good news, there's a fellow named Dan Jewell who has a company, Jewell Wind, which has pioneered community-based energy development, which we're trying to do here in Ohio. We want to have a law on the books that facilitates the ownership of wind farms by individuals and communities as opposed to large corporations. And this is extremely important because in this, the immense profits that come from the wind machines should go to the community and not to private developers.
Mm. What kind of a facilitating law do you need? What does it need to say?
It needs to basically the law in Minnesota, which is extremely successful, is signed by a Republican governor, lays down a boilerplate setup whereby the power purchase agreements that are negotiated between the owners of the wind farm and the utility companies are standardized. And this cuts a huge expense out of the process. Mm-hmm. You still have to negotiate a price between the power company and the owner of the wind farm, but the basics are laid out by the state.
We mentioned the use of alternative renewable energy here in Columbus, and we're not a great place for wind energy, I'm sure. You mentioned heating hot water in an individual home, right? And so you'd put solar panels on the roof. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
And when the sun is shining, it heats the water. But when the sun is not shining, as it doesn't for weeks in the winter, what do you do?
It's still sun. Amazingly enough.
Still enough.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, there's also geothermal, which is very interesting. You know, there's two forms of two major forms of geothermal. One, if you dig down 3 feet in central Ohio, you will always have 55 degrees. 3 to 5 feet. And so when you build a house, or if you want to add this on, you can dig down 3 to 5 feet and run, a field of heat exchanging tubes for air or water, and you'll bring 55 degree heat into your business, into your building, be it a home or a business. So in the winter, it heats to a certain extent, and in the summer, it cools to a certain extent. And you can also go deep down into the earth and get much hotter. Mm-hmm. That's much more expensive. But
how deep do you have to go?
Well, it varies from where you are. In Oregon and in the West Coast and in other places, of course, in Iceland, there's a tremendous amount of geothermal energy that's been tapped. Now, this, again, you can do it in a way that's objectionable. For example, a major geothermal plant in Hawaii, and, of course, they decided to drill right in the middle of an area of a park sacred to the Native Americans, Native Hawaiians. So, it is possible to do these things wrong. The corporations managed to have a very good track record in doing them wrong. We did have a major – the first really big windmill in the United States was in Sandusky, but it was done by NASA, and they built a very, very big windmill, which was a huge mistake, and it didn't work, and gave wind a bad name for 20 years. But then when the Danes got into it, they started again back with small technology and gradually ramped up to the point now where we have windmills as big as the one that was in Sandusky all those years ago, but these work. So, that's a big difference.
We have an email from Jason. He says, when do we begin to focus our attention on energy consumption along with renewable energy? It seems no matter how green the energy we provide, if something isn't done about the outrageous demand for energy worldwide, we're fighting a losing battle, he says.
Yeah, I agree entirely. A big part of Solartopia, the vision of Solartopia, is increased efficiency, which is the cheapest form of new, margin in energy. Negawatts, a concept pioneered by Amory Lovins, where you use less because you're more efficient. That's really where it's at. And, of course, we start with mass transit. The mass transit system in this country was essentially murdered by General Motors between 1920 and the 1950s. It's been very well established. There's really not much debate about it. I'm old enough to remember trolley tracks in Columbus. Mm-hmm. I never rode a trolley in Columbus. They were gone by then, but we had a perfectly viable trolley system. We need to restore the use of our trains in this town. There's right away between Gahanna, downtown, Hilliard, Groveport, Worthington, all these train tracks could be used to be running, self-powered trolleys in and out of the downtown and really alleviate a lot of the traffic.
Especially the current economy, I imagine that's just not going to happen. We're not going to have the money to do it for quite a while.
Well, it's pretty cheap. Back in around the turn of the century, as it were, When the federal government was going to spend $500 million, which they did spend to widen I-71 between Cleveland and Columbus, if we'd taken $50 million, it's all it would have taken to restore basic train service between Cleveland and Columbus. It wouldn't have had to do that widening. You could have run the train for free and come out ahead. And people say, you know, people won't run ride trains. Well, you know, when your choice is the Greyhound or hitchhiking, you will ride the train.
The problem with the train between Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus is, okay, you go to Cleveland or you go to Columbus on the train, then you're stuck. What do you do? I mean, there's no mass transit there.
Well, you have the RTA in Cleveland. There is mass transit there to a certain extent, but you run buses, you run jitneys. I mean, we need a hybrid system. Trains and light rail in the cities is good for the trunk lines. You know, the major routes, they should all be, you should have availability on train. And then you can run, natural gas powered or hydrogen powered or battery powered jitneys and buses, which are becoming very popular. In California, Thousand Palms, there's a hydrogen, solar hydrogen powered bus system where the bus stops have solar panels that convert water to hydrogen and they run the buses. We can do that with batteries. This is all very, it's not rocket science. It's all well known stuff. You use rails on the trunk lines and jitneys in the local areas, and that's the way you succeed.
All right, let's go to our callers. Environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, Solartopia, our green powered Earth, AD 2030. Pete's on the line. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Fred. I just want to make a couple short comments. On nuclear power, there is such a thing as a pebble bed reactor, and I know a little bit about it. It was written up in Scientific American and a publication called Energy's Future, a subscriber edition, and they mentioned that this cannot melt down. Now, I agree the waste problem is a problem. The thing I wanted to say was I saw an article in Science magazine, and they said that essentially there may be an oil crunch sooner than we expect. It may be as soon as 5 years from today, because the people who have the oil are not reinvesting in research and development for new fields. And they're thinking what they do have in reserve, they're going to not produce it right away. They're going to keep it in the ground and wait till they get, you know, a higher price per barrel. So for that reason, the producers may be cutting way back, and it may, you know, boomerang and hit us in the face in 5 years. That's all I'm saying. I think I agree with your guest. We got to have this really quickly. We got to have some real push in Washington to get this thing going.
Well, I hope they do keep the oil on the ground. I mean, the other, aside from the economic constraints, the other problem we have, of course, is global warming and the rising CO2 levels, which are indisputable. We don't have actually global warming is a misnomer as far as I'm concerned. What we have is climate chaos, or what Amy Levin's called global weirding, where the climate is just being wrecked. We don't have a gradual, predictable rise, even rise in temperatures. We have record wind storms, record droughts, record rain, record cold, and all these things are contributing to major chaos on Earth. So the presumption of Solartopia is that not only is our economy dependent on this, but our survival ecologically. And I've used Solartopia as an inevitability. It's a test of our survival instincts. We have to go to renewables. There's just no choice.
Pete, thanks for your call today. Over to Grant. Hi, Grant. You're on the air.
Hi. A couple years ago, I was in college competing in debate, and the topic of debate was for the entire year was how to reduce fossil fuel consumption. And at Arizona State, where I was going to school, our team's plan was to increase nuclear power generation.
Big mistake.
And the reasons that we argued you should do it is because nuclear power is uniquely uniquely suited to desalinization of water, which is going to be important with the population explosion in East Asia and the Indian subcontinent. And the other advantage that it had was we're obviously signatories as a declared nuclear power to the NPT. And one of the obligations that we have is to help countries like Iran develop safe civilian nuclear technology. And the only way that we can do that is by building nuclear power plants in this country, more often than once every 30 years. And so I was just wondering what the guest had to say with regards to those things.
Well, I wish I had a couple hours to respond to all that. I mean, water is a huge problem with nuclear power plants. Aside from not being well suited for desalinization, we've got a situation now where we've had reactors in France and in Alabama have to shut because the rivers they've been using for cooling have exceeded 90 degrees Fahrenheit. In the summer, you cannot the water issue with nuclear power is extremely important. The nuclear plants on rivers like the Hudson River and other rivers around the country are very problematic in hot weather, and there's simply not enough water, cool enough water to cool these reactors. They're extremely inefficient. The idea that nuclear power is an aid to solving the global warming problem is also a tremendous myth. Nuclear power creates global warming gases, and the mining, the milling, the enrichment, the transportation, and the waste management fields. They're absolutely not. They're also unsafe. The previous caller mentioned pebble bed reactors. We do not have a working prototype for a pebble bed reactor. And the other thing you got to remember about nuclear is that it's many years in the future. You cannot, if you committed today to build a nuclear plant, you couldn't have it online in less than 10 or 15 years. And in the interim, the money spent on those nuclear plants could be installing wind, solar, tidal, geothermal.
What about the fact that the major source of nuclear material is, degrading warheads that are in unsafe warehouses in Russia, where underpaid scientists and guards could be easily bought off by people like Osama bin Laden in order to get nuclear material for themselves or for Iran.
Yes, but the use of weapons-grade materials, it doesn't work. It's been tried. It's not cost-effective. It creates more waste than it disposes of. This is a technology that, again, has failed. Pretty much everything about nuclear power technology is a failure, except for nuclear medicine.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thanks, Grant. What the high-grade weapons technology, why doesn't it work?
It's technically infeasible. Just the nature of the weapons-grade material and what's required to convert it and the types of plants that would burn it, it's just not – doesn't make sense.
Hmm.
And tons and tons of plutonium – it only took 6 pounds of plutonium to wipe out Nagasaki that are being created in the nuclear fuel chain are a major world plague. The caller also mentioned Iran. I'd remind our listeners that when the Shah of Iran was in power in the 1970s, there were plans to fund 36 commercial reactors in Iran. And thankfully, they were never built. And then in came the Ayatollah. Can you imagine if the Ayatollah and the Iranian Revolution had access to 36, the nuclear materials from 36 commercial reactors in Iran? What a catastrophe.
Let us go back to our callers with Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hi there. I'm interested in solar power. I'm also interested in the stock market and like to speculate on stuff. I bought some companies like Abengoya and Axiona, and I don't mean to turn you into Lewis Rukeyser, but do you have any stock picks or interesting plays you might be able to suggest or have, at least have me give me something to research or look into?
Well, I wouldn't mention any specific stocks, but if you're interested, A, in investing, and B, in a future, if there are young people listening who want to make a decision about what they're going to do with their lives in the future, then the renewable business is guaranteed to succeed. There are certainly going to be companies that fail. Many of the windmills that were built in California under Jerry Brown in the late 70s, early 80s were scams. They weren't really good machines. It is quite possible to have, bad renewable energy facilities. But in general, I believe that the solartopian sector – and by the way, the only place you can get my book is at harveywasserman.com. I'm basically Internet published, so see me at harveywasserman.com for the book. But the fact is that the solar utopian sector is going to be bigger by far than the dot-coms in the 90s. This is the growth industry in the world. This is a multi-trillion-dollar future with renewables and green power. There will be companies along the way that will fail, that will send people to prison, but overall, this is the where to look. Wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, all those places.
Mike, thanks for your call, and on to Kelly. Kelly, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Fred. Hi, Harvey. Hey. I have 2 points that I found pretty exciting. I heard recently one Ohio power company, I don't know the name of it, is testing installing solar panels on a few homes and then buying the electricity back, you know, sending the electricity back through the grid to the power company.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that was covered in Harvey's book and if that was going to be expanded. And then I keep hearing this fact that if we put just big solar panels in Arizona, like 100 miles by 100 miles, we could power the company or power the country with all the electricity we needed. And I just wondered what Harvey's thoughts on that.
You could, actually. I asked about that. I was at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, and that's basically the dimension, 100 miles on a side. In the desert of Nevada or Arizona, you could do 100% of the electricity in the country, but then you'd have to send it out. And that's not going to work. Now, Al Gore is advocating something right now, which I strongly oppose, which is a national super efficient electric grid that would take electricity from the Southwest and move it around the country. I think that's a bad idea because it's hugely expensive. It's a construction project that will be environmentally damaging, and it will also create an electromagnetic field whose impacts we just don't want to try and calculate. But you are correct that with currently available technology, you could do 100% in a 100 square mile box. But no, I mean 100 miles on the side, it's 10,000 square miles. But the fact is that where the solar panels should go is on rooftops.
Okay.
And you're right about selling electricity back to the grid. Unfortunately, it should be one for one. The utility companies should be forced to buy electricity that you generate with a solar panel at the same price that they sell it to you. But they have power in the legislature and they don't let you do that. So you don't get full benefit by turning back the meter, but that should happen. So the 10,000 square miles of solar panels really should go on the rooftops of the country. In Solartopia, I predict that every rooftop in the world will have photovoltaic cells on them, and I will swear by that. And you can call me when I'm on Fred's show in 2030 and see if that actually happens.
Well, it's a no-brainer. I think the knowledge on how to install these things also is becoming almost public or common knowledge, too.
Well, it's a business. It's a big business. They're business. You know, write me at windhw@AOL.com, and I'll refer you to businesses in the state that will do this for you.
Kelly, thanks so much for your call. So the idea of a 100-square-mile solar cell field, not a good idea. You say it's going to create some sort of electrical field that...
Well, it can be done. They probably need it for Las Vegas. You know, it's amazing how much electricity they use there, although it all comes from Boulder Dam, but I don't wonder how long that's going to last, given water shortages. But you could, with 100 miles on a side, which is 10,000 square miles, you could do the whole United States.
But what's
with
the problem? The problem again is
transmission.
What? But you build transmission lines. So.
Yeah, but you have tremendous loss, and there's environmental impacts, and you don't want to do it. Why do it when you can put the photovoltaic cells on the rooftop?
Aren't there some places, though, in the country that are so cloudy that the cells on the rooftops are not going to power the homes entirely? Right?
Well, we got a lead time here. We can start in the Southwest and sort of gradually get to Buffalo. I assume Buffalo or Seattle will be the last, but there's still sunlight, and as the technology improves, it will become cost effective. Cost effective in Ohio for water heating. Given the rebates and the other setups we have, you can come out ahead with a hot water heater on your house.
What about smaller solar energy fields around the country? I mean, a bit in Las Vegas, a bit over in let's say Alabama. I mean,
they have them actually very successful in California. Mm-hmm. There are 9 major fields. It's a LUZ technology. It's parabolic trough mirrors that focus sunlight on a heat exchanging pipe. And these work. They're profitable. The company that built them was driven into bankruptcy in the early 80s by bad tax policies from Governor Duke Majan, who took over from Jerry Brown. But the facilities themselves continue to operate, and they're very successful. The bottom line is that the Solartopian technology works. It's here. It's available and it's ready to go.
Environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, his new book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Bill is next. Hello, Bill.
Yes, Fred, thank you. I was in Turkey last spring, and I was amazed at the number of solar panels for heating water, which were on the rooftops of virtually every building. These were small individual houses on large apartment buildings, 10 or 12 stories high. There would be 15 or 20 of them. And they consisted of a solar panel, maybe 6 foot by 6 foot, with 2 or 3 tanks attached to it, about the size of oil tanks, and that's where they heated their water. And now Ankara in Turkey is on the same 40th parallel that Columbus is, and as you went further south, there were more and more of them per area. And that's quite feasible. Now, recognize that Turkey does not have natural gas, nor does it have petroleum. So there's an economic factor there instead of there, but I was amazed by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it was legally mandated in Florida in the 1920s. Every home had to have a solar hot water heater. You couldn't build a house in Florida without a solar hot water heater.
They put them
heater.
On the roof, right? Didn't they?
Yeah,
put the,
right.
Yeah, they actually
roof.
Put the tank on the roof, and the sun hit the tank directly.
Right, and yeah. you face into the south, and we can do that in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And you know, one other thing: every house built in the northern hemisphere should be facing south. It's mind-boggling to me all the housing developments that are built, and the windows face north, they face west. I mean, it's ridiculous. Face the windows to the south. Put hardwood trees on the south side in front of the windows, so in the summer the leaves shade the house, and in the winter they drop off. That's really rocket science. And then on the north side you put softwood trees and to protect you from the cold, and that's it. And it, tremendous heat gain in any house. In Ohio, comes from just from putting the windows on the south side.
Mm-hmm. J.D., thanks for your call. Here's Charlie. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks. I was just wondering if you saw any opportunity now with the Obama administration coming in and some group that could coordinate. I mean, maybe they are going to have some nuclear somewhere, but wind in Ohio, solar in the southwest, but somebody putting it together so that there's a combination of government, all these billions of dollars we're going to spend to do transportation in the Northeast corridor so it all links up, so that there's some, like in Colorado, government state tax benefit to heating your water, putting photovoltaic in. I mean, it seems so doable, but there's no leadership here getting it done. And I want
right. Well, you're 100% right. And we've had 8 years of complete brainless nothingness from Washington. The new Department of Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, does seem to have a brain. And if they will avoid the nuclear pitfall and go to solartopian technologies, we can have a huge difference. Look at all the money we spent on the war in Iraq. $3 trillion when we're done. That would never have happened if we were in a solartopian energy mode. You can get the book at my website, harveywasserman.com, or seesolartopia.org. I actually have a theme song from Pete Seeger and an introduction from Robert Kennedy.
You co-wrote the song.
Yes,
you,
I co-wrote a song with Pete Seeger, the great Pete Seeger, and Bobby Kennedy Jr. wrote the introduction. It is the only vision of the planet that really is going to work in terms of having a sustainable economy or a climate future.
Charlie, thanks for your call. Time for a quick question here. A comment from J.D. Hi. J.D., are you here? All right. Let us go on to Barbara. You're on the air, Barbara. And Barbara, turn down your radio because there's a delay. And you'll be very confused. Barbara does not realize I'm talking to her. Let's try one more with Anthony quickly. Anthony, got something quick?
Yes. I was wondering, thanks for taking the call, by the way. I was wondering about the feasibility of feed-in tariffs. Many attribute the success of Germany and Japan's PV success to feed-in tariffs.
Feed-in tariffs are a very good idea. They were developed by Paul Guype, among other things, a great wind expert. They basically give a set fee for renewable-generated power, and this is what really needs to happen so that we can negotiate these contracts with the utility companies, just get this stuff on the grid. Ohio should have feed-in tariffs, and you know, we can get to Solartopia very quickly with renewed mass transit and all the other renewable features, which are ready to go. We have a proven failure with nuclear power. We cannot sustain fossil fuels. We've got to go to wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, and all these technologies are available today.
So environmental activist Harvey Wasserman with us. Solartopia, our green powered earth, AD 2030. Harvey, always a pleasure. Thanks
hey,
for being
great
with
to
us
see
on
you,
the
Fred.
Show.
Thank you.
News is next on listener supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, proud to present Power Philanthropy, a powerful new giving tool available to everyone. More information is available on the web at columbusfoundation.org.